and welcome to the Teaching in Medicine podcast, where we explore effective teaching of the healthcare providers of tomorrow. I am your host, Dr. Kathleen Timmy.
We are lucky to have Dr. Jared Henriksen with us today. Dr. Henriksen is a pediatric critical care physician at the University of Utah and Primary Children's Hospital. He also received his Master of Health Professions Education degree through MGH in Boston. He has academic interests in simulation as a way to enhance clinical education and improve patient safety, and he is the Intermountain Healthcare Simulation Consortium Medical Director. He is here today to discuss the psychology of simulation. Welcome to the Teaching in Medicine podcast.
Thank you so much, Dr. Timmy.
All right. So Dr. Henriksen, when I was initially talking with you about this topic, I was reflecting back on my own residency training. And I have to be honest that I dreaded simulation. I'm someone who really likes to be well prepared for any situation. And just the idea of being put on the spot in front of my peers and attendings was really scary for me, especially early on in training. Is that a sentiment that you've come across before?
Absolutely. I can share that sentiment because I went through simulation as a resident just once, though. A simulation was just beginning. I went through simulation as a med student once. They were just starting the OSCEs. And so I think we were the guinea pigs for that, just when I was going through med school. So I think simulation and simulation debriefing has come a long way since we were in training, and we can do it better than was done in the past.
Yeah, and I know there's a body of evidence around the efficacy of simulation as a teaching tool, and I definitely see its value, so I'm glad we're discussing the psychology behind it today. So tell us more about what your experience with simulation has been like, and how did you get into this field?
You know, I think it fell into my lap. I was fortunate to start here at Primary Children's Hospital, and there was a simulation program already established. Kathleen Bentry was the first medical director of simulation at Primary Children's Hospital. There was a lot of support. There were leaders that were supportive of simulation, and the program had already started. And then Kathleen left, and I think I was the only physician involved in simulation at that point when she was leaving. And so they, I guess, had to ask me to be the medical director. And so it fell into my lap, and it was really fun. I enjoyed it. I enjoy helping people learn, and it can be fun. It does not have to be a chore to learn how to improve. And so the edutainment idea, if you can educate while having some entertainment value, do it in a way that is fun and helpful, and they learn something and can apply it, it's amazing. So I've been doing simulation related things for over a decade, and I'd say it's just building on itself. The thing after thing that we do is just so amazing. I have a lot of great people around me that worked well together, and we've been able to create some fun things and do some fun studies.
I'm always amazed in these interviews by how much of career direction is by happenstance. Like you said, there was that opening early on, and it sort of fell into your lap. I often think like, oh, you must have always known that you wanted to do simulation and had been working on this since residency. But it's I'm always surprised by how much just sort of happens.
I think that there's value in that statement. If you look at what people enjoy, then keep opening those doors. If you enjoy something, open that door and see what you want to do with that. And if there's not a lot of value, okay, close that door. So move forward in the direction that you really enjoy. If it's sepsis, great. If it's anaphylaxis, great. If it's infectious disease, great. And just keep moving and moving in a direction that is fun for you, because careers don't have to be the doldrums. We can make careers that are amazing and fun, and we can last longer than all of the people say. There's the great resignation that's been going on. I think we can have a great time in healthcare, and I'm very optimistic. I wasn't always as optimistic as I am now. I think healthcare is a great place to be.
Yeah, I agree. I have a lot of fulfillment from my job. And I feel very lucky to kind of follow the path that I'm passionate about. So I know that you're an expert in leading simulation, but do you ever still go through it as a participant?
I do go through as a participant, but just real quick, it's hard to think of myself as an expert. There's so many things to learn. I'm not a psychologist. I did psychology as an undergrad at the University of Utah. Because there's so much to learn, it's hard to consider myself an expert. But if I've put in the time and maybe I know a little bit, and I hope to be able to share something that might be useful to your listeners. But I do go through as a participant. Our attendings in our division go through once a year. And the attendings in the emergency department also go through once a year. I think that's the minimum for us. And then we can go through more than once, but I think once a year is what we do. So I have a couple nurse practitioners that make the scenarios for me, and they bring up some doozies. I go through some simulations. I walked in once and there were two mannequins in two different cribs. And yes, both of them had problems. And so I have some fun with it. I know that I'm probably going to make a mistake or two, but I'm going to learn from it. And it's fun for me now. It wasn't always that way.
Do you think it helps you to be a better leader of sim that you still go through it as a participant?
I think so. I think it helps me understand the stress that participants go through, because quite honestly, it's not easy peasy for me. I still have some stress when I go through. I think similar to participants who go through for the first time, it's not my first time, so I can remember my first time in residency. It was not fun. And when we brief someone on simulation, it's when they first come to simulation, we brief them on how things are going to go. We let them see the mannequin. We want them to have an experience that is going to be helpful to them and their learning. And so when we do that, we try and give them some guardrails, so to speak. And so knowing the guardrails, I can go through simulation and concentrate on the learning. Whereas someone who's going through for the first time, their stress comes from perhaps the novelty of it or the ambiguity of the situation. But the idea that they can go through and learn something is real. If we can get away from the idea of, oh, I'm going to have my educational gaps exposed, or, I'm being videotaped, or, I'm performing in front of my peers. Those are hard thoughts. But if we can help a participant get past those and concentrate on learning, I think that is a real benefit for them.
Yeah, despite the discomfort with sim during training, I definitely remember those scenarios. And I think it has made me a better physician overall. So can you help me to understand the psychology of a simulation participant?
I hope so. I'm learning about it myself, but having gone through as a participant and seeing others go through so many times, I hope I have some insights. It is stress provoking, but let me talk about stress for a minute, because not all stress is bad. We need to stay away from the toxic and debilitating stress. That's the stress we need to stay away from. I hear so many things in articles. They say we need to get rid of stress. I don't actually believe that. I think we need some stress to be able to learn. When I've been stressed in my career, I have learned things. And so not all stress is bad. Of course, we need to stay away from the stress that will make our careers just crunkle. But the idea of taking away all stress, I don't think is a good idea. So intentionally, I put people through a little stress, a little challenging stress, to be able to help them understand how to react when a real situation arises. Because quite honestly, we're in a stressful field. Healthcare is stressful in the EDs, in the ICUs, in the ORs. It is stressful when patients deteriorate. It is not a pleasant feeling. We have some cognitive dissonance because we want our patients to do well, yet they're not, and they're deteriorating. And so in our minds, where we want everything to make sense, we want things to go the right way, when we have that cognitive dissonance, it does not feel good. And I want to help people understand it's going to be like that every time. Every time a patient deteriorates in the ICU, I do not feel good about it. It does not jive well with me. I want my patients to do well. And so when we put people through simulation and the patient is not doing well, they're going to feel that stress. It's okay. But what we have to help them do is move past that to be able to care for the patient. So I am intentionally stressing simulation participants to help them understand that they need to do things to help their patients. I think that's the best benefit of simulation, is helping them build their stress capacity so that they can handle these events and get patients cared for in the best manner possible.
I couldn't agree more. I feel like the transition out of training into becoming an attending, and for me in endocrinology, there aren't a whole lot of emergency high stress situations, but just being the final clinical decision maker is very stressful. And I think being able to do that in a protected, nurturing environment is a really healthy exercise. You had mentioned toxic stress. Can you talk more about the difference between toxic levels of stress and that sort of healthy stress that promotes growth?
In the simulation world, there's been an idea that stress happens during simulation, because the ideas out there are that simulation is so stressful, we need to address the emotions of the situation. By briefing the team on stress and helping them understand stress is going to be part of their experience, I can help them move past the toxic part, I hope. We did a study in our simulation center where we were trying to be observant of who was experiencing lots of stress. And all we did was divide it into no stress and then three levels: mild, moderate, and severe stress, or psychological distress is what we called it. But the idea was, can a simulation facilitator see someone who is in distress and help them? What we found is we're not really good at reading other people's minds. It's really hard. What people do is they have impression management skills that we have built up over time. And the idea that I can hold it together so I don't look like I'm emotionally compromised in front of you, that's a real skill that all of us have. We want things to make sense. We want order. Our minds are always trying to have an appraisal of the situation and have it make sense so that we're not just randomly going through life. We like things to be ordered. And so when people have toxic stress, perhaps their stress capacity has been overwhelmed. That study that I was mentioning, we were trying to observe mild, moderate, or severe distress. We couldn't see very much distress. And so we found less than 1% of our participants we could actually tell. And sometimes it was easier. If there's a tear or a crack in the voice or crying, anger, that happens too, because they're so mad that they didn't do things well. When we see that distress, our goal is to run to that concern and try and help. But we don't want people flailing and having that toxic environment, or those feelings of the saboteur feelings of, oh, I'm terrible. I didn't do it right. I can't believe it. Someone must think I'm an idiot. We don't want that. We want people to be in control of their emotions and move through simulation in a way that is helpful to learning. Yet, I know going through simulation is hard. And some people have had feelings that they're not good enough. I had one resident say, I don't know that I can be a resident. And I was like, that's not what simulation is for. We wanted simulation to help you learn. You are a good resident and you are learning. That's the point of this. So when someone goes through and they have those feelings of distress, they're pretty good at hiding it, first of all. But second, when we do see it, we call it emotional surveillance in our program. We want to run to it and help someone who is perhaps suffering from that toxic and debilitating stress.
And along those lines, what would you do if you noted some of those outward signs of distress? How would you help that participant?
We have a few ways to try and help someone. We can even stop the simulation if needed. We can stop the debriefing. We can take a pause. But we do try and give them control of the situation and say, hey, I noticed a tear. Can you tell me more about what's going on in your mind? And when someone is in that state, a lot of times they don't want to talk about things, but the tear has been exposed and they will say, you know what, I've had a hard time. This winter has been really hard. Or, you know, this scenario replicated something that I had a hard time with before. And so simulation can hit hard. And anyone going through healthcare, taking care of people, can understand when something just hits us pretty hard. I had an experience where in the ICU, I was taking care of a child that I knew was going to die. She was a little blonde 7-year-old. And I had a really hard time with that. And then I realized a little bit later, wow, at the time I had a blonde 7-year-old. And so these situations can arise at any point when we see someone in distress. I guess that principle applies not only in simulation. If you see someone in distress, go ask them, hey, are you okay? Can I help? And then our whole healthcare environment will improve. But in simulation specifically, when we see someone struggling, we will ask them, how can I help? First of all, concentrating on telling them there's going to be some stress, and then concentrating on the learning points. What can we do better? What excellence can we repeat? Those are the ideas that we want people to come away with in simulation. But when someone is distressed, we really do need to help them and we'll ask them about things.
This is sort of a random side thought, but I think during medical school, a lot of the simulation type activities are graded. So standardized patient encounters, OSCEs, those kind of things have grade value. Whereas in training, I think it's more of a formative experience. They're not going to fail residency, right? So I think making that transition from like, this is not a graded activity, this is something for your own professional development, I wonder if that's a bit of a hurdle too.
That's a great insight, because in medical school, I would call it a high stakes simulation where they have to pass to be able to move on. I remember I was stressed during my OSCE, right? I had a guy that was a teenager that was pretending to have Osgood-Schlatter disease, and I had no idea what that was. And just thinking about the stress that created. And so the idea of high stakes simulation is real. Nursing students also go through that. And so the idea of trying to ease into the training simulation environment where we really just want to improve. If I'm putting people through rapid response simulation, for example, I want them to help the deteriorating patients. And going through that rapid response simulation is hopefully going to prepare them for when they have a deteriorating patient. But it is different. Training simulation or formative simulation, as you mentioned, that's a great point, distinguishing between those two, simulation for a grade versus simulation as a formative experience.
Thinking back on the study that you discussed and that many participants are not showing outward signs of distress, how might you help somebody who's experiencing distress, but you can't necessarily see it?
I think the briefing of the simulation event is a really important place to help people understand that they will experience some stress. So when people do experience that stress, they are not as surprised by it. And so that they can get through it themselves and get onto the learning. I think that is a really crucial moment prior to the event. And so I do like that pause to think about, okay, I'm going to be stressed. What can I do? Well, I can do things to try and get out of that stress. If I don't do something during that event, that's going to cause more stress. But if I can do something to get more information and proceed with patient care, then I will be able to get through this event and learn some things. So it's the actions that lead to more understanding. If you do things, it may be the right action, it may be the wrong action, but if you do something, then you'll get some information. If it was, I think we look at error a little bit incorrectly. If I do something for a patient and it's the wrong thing, there's probably something that will help me correct and go back and not do that again. For example, if I'm not bag masking correctly, the patient will desat. And so that is an indication to me that I need to get a better seal, or I need to pull up on the jaw, or I need to have my respiratory therapist bag more vigorously, or something. Something needs to change. So it's not necessarily an error that is the problem. Errors are the guide rails to try and help us get the best care for someone. And so if we do those course corrections all the time, whenever we see an error or we course correct, that's the best thing. But we actually have to do something to be able to hit those guardrails. If you're not doing anything, that's the big problem. You actually have to do something to figure out your way forward.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know you've mentioned briefing that you do before the simulation, and it seems like psychological safety is a huge component of that time. Can you help us to understand what psychological safety is and what are the dangers of not establishing psychological safety?
Thank you for bringing that up. It is a really big idea to have psychological safety for your simulations. If you can establish that, then it's going to be a great simulation event. But let's define it. There's a Harvard Business School professor named Amy Edmondson that defined psychological safety for us in healthcare. Well, really for everyone. She's written a couple of books about it. But what she said is this: psychological safety is a belief that one will not be punished or humiliated for speaking up with ideas, questions, concerns, or mistakes. So if you can speak up without fear of retribution, then that's a psychologically safe environment. It's not something I have myself, but I can help create for my team. So I can't give another person psychological safety. I can hopefully do some things that will promote psychological safety in my team members, but I can't just give it to them like I can give them a bag of popcorn. And so the idea is create psychological safety for this learning environment. And now we can talk about the learning and the improvement, repeat the excellence, avoid the pitfalls. Now we can concentrate on our intentions of what I want to do the next time I see a deteriorating patient. And so if psychological safety is present, people can ask their questions and see what they can learn. Hey, I don't know about that. Can you tell me more? Hey, I did this, but was that the right action? And so people will probe and have some introspection. That's a big deal with learning. I'm going to mention a theory of learning by Noel Birch. He created it in the 1970s, but it's the idea of conscious competence and unconscious competence. But we don't start there. We start with unconscious incompetence. We don't know what we don't know. And that's where a lot of trainees are. Maybe they don't know the Versed dose, intranasal Versed dose for a seizure. The idea of not knowing what you don't know is real for all of us. Because, when I'm a new attending, I didn't know how to bill for things. When I'm a new attending, I didn't know how to act as an attending yet. I'd never been an attending. And so you have to learn these things by going through them. And then you gain, first of all, you have a consciousness of your incompetence. That's the next step. And then you have conscious competence. You're really trying to do the right thing and you know how to do it, but you have to concentrate on it. The last stage is unconscious competence. And that idea of doing things and doing it well, just like riding a bike, is real. We can get there, but nobody starts there. And so moving through these stages is important for a trainee. And so when we are trying to gain competence, simulation can help us gain that competence by exposing our educational gaps. And it's okay. I've had gaps exposed many times in simulation. And I hope that I can learn from all those experiences instead of concentrating on, oh, woe is me. I did something in front of this team that they didn't expect.
So this conversation reminds me of the Johari window. I don't know if you've heard of that, but there are things that we know about ourselves. There's things we don't know about ourselves. And then there's things that other people know about us and things that other people don't know about us. And I think the concept is, you know, with feedback or with simulation, bringing to light what we don't know about ourselves, but other people do. So yeah, I really appreciate exploring theory there.
I love theory and combining it with simulation. And I'll tell you, I'll give you an example of the Johari window. When a person is leading a simulation scenario and they are not speaking loud enough, and then in the debriefing, they can understand other people's perception that they were not loud enough during that situation where so many things are happening, they need to be louder. They are able to get the other person's perception that you need to speak louder during an event like this. And so it's powerful to get other people's perceptions of us. We learn things because people are so smart.
So thinking about psychological safety, are there certain things that you say or do during that brief that help to establish the safe learning environment?
I think there's quite a few things. I will start with something called the basic assumption. It is a concept out of the Center for Medical Simulation in Boston. And they say that people are smart and skilled and want to do their best. And we apply that basic assumption to everyone. And we have a sign up in every simulation center. And we point it out at the beginning of the simulation event. We expect that they're going to do their best and that they're going to learn. We also teach them a little bit about stress, or I do when I welcome a group, I teach them a little bit about stress and that we are going to give them a stress inoculation, so to speak, and help them build their stress capacity. That's usually well received because simulation can be a stressful event. We don't want it to be toxic. We want it to be uplifting and strengthening for their careers. And so when we have that attitude and we try and portray that, I think it does create psychological safety. We want people to speak up. We want people to speak up during the simulation so that their team members can know what they're thinking and they can do the best they can. And then in the debriefing, we want people to speak up. So we invite questions. I also can express my fallibility because I've made mistakes in simulation. My first simulation here as an attending, you know, after fellowship, after all my training, I graduated, and then I went through a simulation and I did terrible. And I was embarrassed because Kathleen Bentry had put me through and I didn't do as well as I thought I should. And so I can tell them that I know how they feel. And I also go through simulation once a year, at least, sometimes more. But because I know how they feel as a simulation participant, I hope that eases how they feel and that the stress, the toxic stress, can be lifted.
What an opportunity it is to make those mistakes in a controlled environment where there's no patient harm, rather than, you know, fumbling through these mistakes at the real bedside.
That brings up a point of simulation debriefing is much different than real event debriefing, because we can just reset the mannequin in simulation. In real event debriefing, it's a little bit different. You can't reset the clock. The patient may have been harmed or worse. And the idea of debriefing those hard events also needs some careful handling.
Can you talk more about what you do in debriefing with simulation?
I think a real big advantage is I'm behind the glass during the simulation scenario, and I can just think about how things are going in there, and I can write down things that are said, and I have a time, a clock that I know when events happened. And so with that information, I can now go into the debriefing and help them understand what happened. What I'm trying to do in a debriefing is help them discover what happened and discover everyone's thoughts surrounding the event. And so discovery is the first stage of debriefing that we have categorized. The second stage of debriefing is learning. And again, we want people to repeat the excellence and avoid the pitfalls. And so we talk about those. How did you know how to do that so well? Or can you tell me more about your thoughts when CPR started? Perhaps CPR wasn't done in the best manner. I can ask, hey, I noticed that the chest was not moving really deep during the CPR. Can we talk about that for a minute? And so we use a technique called advocacy inquiry, where we state what we see, and I can give my opinion on what I see, and then I ask them about what they thought. And so it's not me lecturing to them. It really isn't. If I'm lecturing, I am not debriefing well. If I can help them discover what happened and learn from those events, that's amazing. And now the third stage of debriefing is application. We want them to take what they learned and apply it to their careers. And so we ask them, how are you going to apply what you learned to your next shift? And if they can make some intentions, that's wonderful. That's what we want them to do. And we usually go around the room and have everyone state an intention, something that they are going to do differently as a result of the simulation. And so that's the big secret, perhaps: discovery, learning, application, trying to help them apply those excellent things that they learned.
I really like that framework, and I feel like it could be applicable to other situations as well, like even in the clinical learning environment. So as a participant is going through the different phases of simulation, the brief, the actual scenario, and the debrief, what do you think is going through their mind at those different stages?
Well, I think having been a participant in simulation, I can say it's like a little bit of, oh, I'm doing this. And then they're going through it, trying to do the best they can. And then in the debriefing, they're like, oh man, what did I just do? And what did I not do? People are smart and they're analyzing their actions all the time. And so it's okay to have those feelings. What we want to help people understand is, in simulation, we really just want to help them improve. And so if they go through these experiential learning is a huge component to an individual's career trajectory. If they go through things and they learn from it, that's amazing and that's great. That's what we want. So we are providing them with these experiences. Now, not all of them are wonderful. Sometimes the teams don't do as well. Other times the teams do wonderful. And so when a team doesn't do so well, there needs to be a little bit of an accounting. We want people to be held to a high standard, right? Because we want the best care for the patients. And so when something is not done well in the simulation, we will hopefully bring it up in an effort to help them reach the minimum passing standard, reach and get better. We have a theory, we have a saying in simulation: there is no end to better. Keep expectations high. There is no end to better. So when people are going through, I know there's a little trepidation. I have that same idea. But when we go through, if we can view it as a learning experience, it's going to be such a better experience.
And then thinking about the simulation facilitators, I know we discuss some of the best practices around briefing and debriefing. Is there anything else that facilitators should be aware of, either before, during, or after simulation?
The technique that we advocate and we're trying to teach is pragmatic debriefing with emotional surveillance, because we want people to talk about what happened, discover what happened so they can repeat the excellence and avoid the pitfalls. And so facilitators are really trying to just have a conversation and facilitate the learning. To be honest, when a facilitator doesn't have to do that much talking, they're doing a really good job. And the team is just teaching themselves, noticing what went well and what they could have done better. And the facilitator could start out with a question or an advocacy inquiry statement, and then the team just takes it and does amazing things. And so the facilitator is really there to facilitate the learning rather than teach. That's the difference between facilitation and actually teaching in front of a classroom.
And then during the simulation event, do you try to stay quiet, stay behind the glass, or do you ever intervene or assist during the actual event?
You know, there's a way to do simulation called rapid cycle deliberate practice. It's a fun theory out of Johns Hopkins. Betsy Hunt did this paper. And what you can do in simulation, because you want them to be successful, you don't let them not notice CPR is needed for 15 minutes and say, when are they going to do CPR? You know, a minute or two after CPR is needed, say the SATs are gone and the patient is in PEA, the patient needs CPR. If the team is not doing it, we don't want them to fail. So you can pause the simulation, debrief a tiny bit, help them understand what is needed, and then you can exit the room again and say, go. And you can rewind time too, because it's just a subjective thing. Hey, I want you to go back to the beginning of when you noticed that the SATs went away. Go to that point and we will restart the simulation. Then you walk out of the room. Participants are able to have that perception of time. You tell them what to do and they will do it. The rapid cycle deliberate practice is a fun way to use simulation debriefing. And we do sometimes go in and pause when the team needs a little bit of direction.
Yeah, that's great. So it's not an entirely hands-off experience. Sometimes you help lead them towards the learning objective or, you know, towards the outcome.
Yeah, facilitation is an active process. It's not, we're just, you know, taking a drink, having a candy bar behind the glass.
So what recommendations do you have for trainees who participate in simulation during their training? How can they get the most out of these educational opportunities?
I think if I were to give some recommendations, they would include go through to learn. These experiences will be a little stressful. That's okay. I think people are taught that stress is bad. And honestly, some stress is bad and we need to avoid it. But learning stress, the challenging stress, we need to actively pursue that. I want them to go through simulation and learn rather than going through simulation to beat themselves up. That's not fun. We have saboteurs in our minds that really eat at us sometimes and just make us feel like dirt. We don't need to pay attention to any of those thoughts. We need to go through with a learning attitude and improvement. And there's constant improvement. Nobody can know it all. Nobody does know it all. People who are experienced in a certain field are better than others. Like me trying to do endocrinology, I know DKA. You get me in an outpatient environment, I would fail drastically. I know a little bit about critical care, and so I can help trainees move in that direction. But nobody can know it all. So go through these experiences with an attitude of learning and improvement, and you're going to be better off. Don't go through beating yourself up.
That's great advice. Anything else around the psychology of simulation that we're missing that you wanted to discuss today?
You know, you've given me a real treat to be able to talk about something that I love. And so talking about all these things has been really fun. I've been able to cover a lot of area with you, and building people's stress capacity is what we're aiming for. Because a trainee doesn't have a lot of stress capacity at the beginning, but again, that's normal for a trainee not to have a lot of stress capacity. So we are aiming to build their stress capacity by putting them through a little stressful environment, a stressful event, and then they can become a better clinician. And so our goals are improvement. And I think that's been brought out in the discussion. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really love the analogy of the stress inoculation, that, you know, through stress inoculation, through these controlled, supportive encounters, that we can build up capacity for stress, because it's certainly not going away. as we move through this healthcare journey. I think stress is also a sign that you care, right? Like if you didn't care deeply about your patients and their outcomes, you wouldn't feel that stress that we experience when we want them to do well.
Absolutely. 100% agree.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today. I'll close today by asking you, what teaching pearl or piece of advice would you like to leave us with? And it can be related to simulation or anything.
You know, I think the ability to have introspection and understand that improvement is the goal, not perfection. I think that's a really big pearl that I wish I would have learned earlier, because introspection leads to improvement. You think of any project that you've been on, when you have a chance to think about it or ask a mentor or be coached on a subject, the introspection that you have allows you to improve. Many of us are running around trying to do so many things. We don't have a lot of time for introspection. But if we can make time and have some introspection on our careers, on our days, on our projects, I think we'll gain a lot.
Well, thank you, Dr. Henriksen, for spending time with me today. I really have enjoyed our conversation and look forward to inviting you back at some point.
I would love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Teaching in Medicine podcast, with new episodes on the first Monday of every month. Please check us out on Facebook and Instagram, and reach out if you have any ideas for episodes.